Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies. I'm Matt.
I'm Nell.
The podcast, and this podcast is where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on what are now obsolete formats. They weren't, you know, we started in the VHS era, and VHS was everything, and then it wasn't, and now it's nothing. So here we are, and our film for this episode is All the Right Moves, starring Tom Cruise.
Very young Tom Cruise.
Very young Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise so young, he probably couldn't afford to get a body double. Probably couldn't ask for that and had to do the nude scene, which we'll talk, we got to talk about that. But in 1983, when the film came out, it was kind of a big deal. It came months after Risky Business and is the months after Tom Cruise was made a star by that, you know, sliding in his socks in a button-up shirt in his underwear and Risky Business scene. That, you know, he's a household word. And we have it on, I guess we need to talk about this, we have it on CED, getting it only a few months ago from the Duncansville Flea Market.
So can you talk, maybe you should talk about what a CED is.
CED stands for Capitance Electronic Disc System. It is the obsolete format that only existed on the North American market from 1981 to 1986. It is the format, actually, that bankrupted RCA. They spent $600 million in about 20 years making this video home video format ready for public consumption, and it took so long to get it together that it actually hit the market after Laserdisc and after VHS, and America said, what the hell do we want that for? Even though RCA figured that between one in four and one in three American homes would have one by 1985. And instead they didn't. But what the disc is, it is a lacquer disc with a magnetic coil in it. It's a record that plays a movie. And it's a very fragile record that can only be housed in a plastic container that you can't open by yourself. Only the player, only the machine you watch these things on can open the disc. And we've watched this movie a second time to prepare for this podcast. And we found that the disc actually degenerated from our first viewing a few weeks ago into our viewing this afternoon.
Yeah, so for people who are older, it looks like a bloated disc drive. People who are younger, it looks like a super bloated icon that you click on when you say save.
Yes.
So it's a giant disc drive that it's housed in, and because it's so sensitive, if it gets dust on it, the dust will actually fuse to the disc,
operating the making the thing. And so this also, it's a film that skips like a bad record.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of skips where it will. People will walk across the room multiple times as ghosts before you get to the next line of dialogue. So that's what CED is. And the fact that we bought this disc in 2020, I think, is the true spirit of the podcast. So that's the format we want. We do own it on DVD as well. And the reason for that, of course, is that I have... Well, we are in Western Pennsylvania.
Yes.
This film was shot in Johnstown. And I have this slight personal connection. My family's from Johnstown. The Ampipe High School scenes were shot in my mom's high school. The football scenes were shot at Point Stadium in downtown Johnstown. So these are places we've been to and that I have somewhat of an emotional connection to. So
now I do not have an emotional connection to Johnstown besides that Matt's family is there. I'm just going to be honest with you. It's the 13-year-old girl in me who heard you could see Tom Cruise's penis for a second that I was like, oh, I got to have that movie. So there's that, you know, that it's actually true. It's very, very brief, but
yes. You
do get a glimpse of pre-super famous Tom Cruise penis in it.
Yes.
But, you know, I wanted it just because there was all of that mythology around.
It's mentioned in Scream.
It is mentioned in Scream.
That's the movie they rent, and that's the only thing they talk about. You can see Tom Cruise's penis. Like, that is it. And honestly, even though I have that emotional connection, even though I saw the movie when I was a child, probably too young for the Tom Cruise penis scene, but I watched that movie with my parents. That, I think, was the mythos of the film, and that was what it was worth to people. Right. Yeah. And so a big part of this podcast is, what does it mean to revisit a film, you know, decades later on these obsolete formats? What's it mean to watch this film in the 2020s?
You know, it's so interesting because when I first saw this movie, and I was probably maybe like a preteen, maybe 10, 11, 12, when I first saw this movie, and I did see it on TV, so there was commercials. You did not see Tom Cruise penis. So I didn't get to see that until I was much older. You know, as a good Catholic girl, you're like, ooh, I can't watch that scene. But I didn't like it. I really did not like the movie at the time, and I didn't like... I'm not actually a huge Tom Cruise fan, so I didn't like the film at the time. I didn't like the pacing of it. I didn't like that it wasn't a traditional romantic comedy or a romantic film. I'm not a big sports movie type of person either. So there was many things beyond, you know, had Tom Cruise and he was super popular at that time, and that's why you would watch or revisit this movie at the time. Beyond that, it had Tom Cruise. There wasn't anything that really connected with me around this particular film as a kid.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're going to talk about it, but the end of the film doesn't follow the traditional arc of a film. It's there is no big redemption game where he gets the trophy and he's the big hero and
he played the homecoming game.
Yeah, and he won it and he's this big hero and everyone loves him. That does not happen. So for a kid, that's disappointing because that's what's supposed to happen in a Hollywood film, is there's supposed to be a hero and there's supposed to be someone who does it and gets it right and they're celebrated for it. That does not happen in this movie.
Yeah, which I will say, in our little bit of research before we do these podcasts, I like to look at reviews from the time. Speaking of good Catholic girl, Catholic bishops... Movie Reviews gave the film an O for morally objectionable for the penis scene. And there is talk of an abortion that's very casual. I mean, it actually says the film lacks moral perspective, which I think is an interesting thing to argue with. This is why you read reviews, people. This is why you listen to this podcast, to argue with it, right? Hopefully you're arguing with us. If you know us personally, next time, I saw that movie and that's bullshit. No.
They do make the good decision what would be deemed the good Catholic decision. They decide to keep the baby.
They do keep the baby. Married. So the abortion isn't had, but there is casual talk of it and this graphic sex scene. So yeah, so that's the interesting about lack of moral perspective. The New York Times review at the time kind of was very nonplussed. It kind of was like, oh, it's a new take on the Horatio Alger story. It's the American Dream story where everything works out. But it's one of those weird, sometimes you get movie reviews that it's like, it's different, but not different enough. And it really doesn't remind me of things I saw before, so I didn't like it. Which is like such, ugh. But who did really like the movie in earnest? And I think somebody who understood the film the way I see it now, or when I revisit it, I just read the Roger Ebert review. And he said his first job was covering high school sports in journalism, his first journalism job. And he always thought it was strange at the time, he said, how tense and meaningful those games felt. That was just high school sports.
Yeah.
And for him, it was almost like, oh, yes, All the Right Moves reminded me of this and explained this to me, you know. And he found, the end kind of astonishing because... there is a happy ending, which the first time we rewatched this film a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh, it's so cheesy. It kind of works out.
Yeah.
But there is an argument to be made that they're honest with each other and they apologize.
Yeah.
And things aren't necessarily completely solved, but they move forward together.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for those of you who have not seen the film, just to kind of give alert. You... a brief overview, but you know, Tom Cruise plays Steph, who's a football player, and he knows that he's not going to be a Steeler. Like, he's not going to go on to professional playing, but he knows that he is good enough to get to college. And so he's a senior. He's hoping to get a scholarship so that he can go to college and get a college degree. There's a huge big game, and it's not necessarily his fault that they don't win the game, but he's a part of it. But he does stick up for the guy who fumbled the ball. And the coach gets really angry at him, kicks him off the team, and really blacklists him from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And so any college that calls interested in Steph, he basically says, Steph is trouble, you don't want him. And so really the big chunk of the film ends up being Steph trying to recover from that error, to be honest with you. So he's trying, he did join a group of people who vandalized the coach's house because they were angry that the team had lost this big game. And so it becomes this journey of how does he fix this situation? Because he knows he needs to go to college, because if he doesn't go to college, he's going to end up in the mills.
Because he has to make all the right moves.
Interesting thing about it ends up happening, and that the coach realizes that what he did was wrong, blacklisting him was wrong. And the way the film ends is they both kind of apologize to each other.
They both apologize together. They both take responsibility.
Yeah.
And they realize, I think that's the thing, even, you know, your ambiguity talking about the big game scene, which the back of the CED mentions that they actually, the screenwriter and the director worked with an actual football coach and recruited a group of high school Western Pennsylvania high school all-stars to play real games, and that Tom Cruise and Paul Karafotis, I don't even know who that is and what he played, actually both got concussions from the football scenes in the movie, and that Tom Cruise's character not only interception leading to a touchdown, but then gets the pass interference call that puts Ampipe, you know, they're back to the goal line and whatever. And then there's this whole business about, oh, I should have just taken a safety and we would have won the game. Which, I mean, that's a real technical knowledge of football.
Yeah.
In there. And so it's like there is this give and take. They would not have had the lead if it wasn't for Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
And they partially anyway. And if there wouldn't have been the losing score partially because of Tom Cruise.
Well, I think the interesting thing about it too is that both he and the coach are guilty of showboating, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Tom Cruise is showboating, like he desperately wants to go to college. So,
and this game was going to be the game. They were going to beat the undefeated local rich kid high school.
Absolutely. So it was this huge, there was a lot that was going to it, and they knew there was going to be a lot of colleges there looking at athletes. And it's the same for the coach. The coach, both Tom Cruise and the coach are desperate.
Are looking to get out of
To get out of Ampipe. And so the coach is angry because he didn't win the game, and he knows that there was colleges looking at him as well. So that's also the funny part about it, is that they both made the decisions that they made because they wanted to show off to a group of recruiters from colleges across the United
States.
Across
the country. And it was about getting out of. Which I think for me also in tying, you know, because we went to college near Johnstown where the film was shot. And again, my family's from there. I still have family there. It's interesting to me there, you know, in spite of what the Catholic bishops say, there was this weird, interesting moral perspective to the film in that the team truly is a team. And while there are heroic plays being made, it is about the team effort.
Yeah.
And also that, what does it mean to have pride in a place or to be accomplishing something in a place, but your biggest goal is to get out of that place? Which I know a lot of folks, and we also have friends that are from that area, for whom that's been a big part of negotiating their sort of teen aspirations and their adult lives. What does it mean to have a place that's home that is so deeply flawed that, you know, has not recovered from the new economy that happened with Reagan? I mean, it's a very interesting, like, Reagan-era film where there's deindustrialization that there are so few opportunities for so many people you know, it's not, there's no future in unskilled labor. You have to get an education. You have to get away from this place.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Johnstown, actually, today is the anniversary of the big flood for Johnstown.
The 1889 flood. You got to specify with Johnstown.
Because there was multiple.
There were three.
There were multiple floods. But that flood came because there was an earthen dam that was made so that actually the kind of industrialists in Western PA could have a lake and a place to summer away from all the pollution that the mills were creating. And it was not a well-made dam.
And it were well maintained.
And it burst and it actually destroyed and decimated the town. They did recover from it, but Johnstown, you know,
it's why my family moved to Johnstown. Actually, they were living in Cleveland and there was this promise of rapid, you know, economic rebuilding and growth and jobs. And so my family left Cleveland for Johnstown.
So Johnstown is wealthy at the time, definitely was wealthy with water and wealthy with coal and wealthy with resources. And so steel and coal were the big industries that supported Johnstown. And as we know, foreign steel became much cheaper. And so we saw
tariffs dropped.
So we saw a lot of loss in jobs. And that's exactly what happened to Johnstown. So if you drive through Johnstown, you'll just see a lot of empty mills and a lot of devastation that happened to that area.
And for folks like us who know the area, you know, you go every, they're big, you know, the big sort of public works project other than fixing the sewers is to just knock abandoned buildings down. And so buildings just kind of, if you go through Johnstown about every 6 months, there'll be just places that are just gone.
Yeah.
And that's Johnstown, and that's what that is. And so in also in a very interesting way, and I think this is maybe the transition to thinking about how we see this film today, it is a very realistic chronicle of what it means to live in a place like that and to be in that place. And to be in a place where maybe, you know, there really aren't easy answers. I mean, this could be an interesting bookend. You watch All the Right Moves for the beginning, understand the first term of Reagan, and then Roger and Me for the second.
Yeah.
Revisiting Roger and Me a couple years ago, it was amazing how no one had an answer. Mm-hmm. What do we do now? And nobody knew. There was only this really individualistic.
Yeah.
Like, I'll get an education. I will get out. I will get away.
Yeah.
And leave this, we're getting out of here. That was the phrase. And yeah, I think that sort of paralysis and that sort of,
well, I think, you know, there is that very real scene where the mill has massive layoffs.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise's dad is not laid off, but his brother is laid off. But one of his teammates, both his brother and dad are laid off.
Yeah.
And that teammate is desperate. He wants to drop out of high school. He wants to get a job.
He needs
because there's no money. And the coach says, no, you stay on the team, stay on the team. And he actually ends up, that student ends up getting arrested for armed robbery. And so it's a reality. And I think it's sometimes hard to think about that reality if you didn't grow up in that area, that your household is dependent on this industry. And if everyone is laid off, how do you survive? And so living through that and growing up with that, there is definitely this thought and this need of, I need to find a way out. I need to find a more stable career. And I look at actually, you know, just even for Matt's family, you know, most of his relatives have gone on to get college degrees and none of them are affiliated with the steel industry in any way, shape or form. They're in like education, banking.
Well, so this is the fascinating thing. My Uncle Bernie, when he was still with us. Mm-hmm. My Uncle Bernie, my grandfather was a steelworker. My grandfather, I believe, worked in the mill that they use in the film.
Oh, wow.
Bernie was an environmental scientist for U.S. Steel.
Oh, was he? Oh, I didn't
realize. He worked for the steel company.
But in a different way.
But he worked in the downtown office tower.
Yeah.
He was an environmental engineer or a scientist for U.S. Steel.
But his degree was in environmental science, right?
Yes, or something science.
Yeah, and so you have other members who are in medicine and the health industry and education.
Yeah.
But, you know, very much wanted to do something that they could have a more stable career and stable job with.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it was also, I mean, that was part of, wasn't that part of the sort of what was expected, the immigrant cycle in this country? Yeah. You know, you come, there's manual labor, then there's laborers, and then there's the next generation or future generation becomes a professional. In fact, Tom Cruise's character says that in the film.
Yeah.
I want to be an engineer. All my father, my brother, my father, my grandfather all worked in the mill making steel. I want to have a say in what happens after the steel's made.
Yeah.
Which is, again, I mean, is this take on the American dream. Again, the New York Times review from 83 talks about it as it's a Horatio Alger story or a take on it.
Yeah.
Or it's somewhat kind of a... I don't know. Was this film too earnest for its time? Well, there's that
bootstrap,
right?
Maybe. I mean, I think there is that bootstrap type of component mentality around it.
Which I think is interesting, though, because I think this film illustrates a success story. But again, it's how narrow that story is and how few... there is opportunity.
Yeah.
But you literally have to make all the right moves. Like, you cannot make a mistake before the age of, like, 25. Which is what we know about people growing up in poverty.
Well, yeah.
Is that it takes a decade, and it takes a decade of literally nothing going wrong.
Yeah. And generations to break out of poverty.
And generations.
And I think also, you know, Matt and I are both educators. I work with the younger group. He works with the older group. But also, like, an 18-year-old makes stupid mistakes all the time, right? So Tom Cruise mouthing off to his coach is not a shocker. 18-year-olds do stuff like all the time.
Yeah, they pull pranks, they goof off in class.
They make mistakes. And the scene where he ends up being a part of a group that trashes the coach's house, he actually got picked up by a group of like older guys.
Yeah, it's the adults that lead him into this.
And he throws some trash, but when he realizes the adults are actually like smashing windows and defacing the house, he actually tries to stop them.
Yeah.
And they actually ditch him. And so he has to run off on his own out of this situation. But so all this pressure around him, and he's 18 making 18-year-old mistakes.
And there are cautionary examples around him of people who mess up, who make the one mistake,
like his friend Brian, who's played by the lesser Penn.
Yes.
Chris Penn plays it. Chris Penn, who showed up in a lot of 80s movies. So if you're a fan of 80s movies, you know Chris Penn very, very well. He plays his best friend Brian, and Brian gets his girlfriend pregnant. Yes. And he decides to give up a very promising scholarship to marry his girlfriend and to work in the mills and raise his child.
To stay in Ampipe.
Yes, absolutely.
Which I think is the other thing we have to talk about Leah Thompson's character and the complexity of that character.
Yeah, we had talked about the Bechdel test with it, and I think she, for me, is such a dynamic, fascinating character. And she is awesome. Like, she's an amazing, amazing character. And I actually read that they wanted her to do more nude scenes, and she was going to back out of the movie because she didn't really want to do nude scenes. And Tom Cruise actually convinced them to reduce the number of nude scenes.
Really?
Because he really wanted her in that role, which is kind of interesting when you think about it. But she plays his girlfriend in the film.
And she's the girlfriend, she's in the band, and she is also a character that is aware that her opportunities are limited. You know, that only football players get scholarships out of Ampipe High, music majors don't get scholarships out of Ampipe. And so there is this interesting question, and there's this amazing scene between her and the woman who plays Craig T. Nelson's wife. She goes to talk to him about what happened, or them about what happened. And they talk about what it means to grow up in a place. And she, the wife of the coach, is from, I'm assuming, Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Which, again, is another Johnstown-y sort of place. And they talk about, you love someone, but you have to let them go.
Yeah.
And if they go, you lose them. And that to love someone is to allow them to get out of. Even if that means dooming yourself. Which is interesting, but again, that is part of, I think, what it means to be from that sort of place.
Yeah, I love, she's not in the film a ton, right? Like, but I love all of her scenes. And there's, actually the scene where they're making out in the car, and she tells him to stop. And he gets angry and frustrated with her about it. And she's just like, I'm nervous. I don't want to end up pregnant. And it was just like this beautiful, honest conversation. And then that conversation where she's angry at him because, you know, football players get scholarships. And she's worried about ending up as a clerk.
Yeah.
And just talking about her frustration because she loves music and she wants to be able to perform music.
Which reminds me, that's another interesting thing about that time. Mm-hmm. Is that, this other labor. I don't want to end up as this other labor that's important and devalued.
Yeah.
You know, which is very much the sentimentality of the time, is that you go to college, don't be a grocery store clerk.
Right.
And not saying that, you know, anything about living wages or all work has dignity and deserves to be compensated. None of that stuff, which was very much the zeitgeist at the time. But if we're talking about these scenes, we're talking this dialogue, I think we have to talk about the screenwriter, Michael Caine. Not that Michael Caine, but Michael Caine, the screenwriter, who put this together, but is also known for...
Smokey and the Bandit.
Two.
I believe it was part two. Let me
Part two, not one. Two. He got the sequel.
Yeah, Smokey and the Bandit, part two. He came up with the story for it. Which is kind of interesting. And when you look at
what else did he do? And he did Jaws 3D.
Jaws 3D.
Which was a horrible thing.
Yeah. And so
episodes of MacGyver.
And then the rest of these films I have really not heard of.
So this was his one shot.
Basically, yeah.
It was his one shot at making art and telling the great American story.
Yep.
And then he ended up writing Jaws 3D. And Smokey and the Bandit Part 2, which is... in some ways, kind of tragic, you know, because I think if we're ready, and it's about time for the big five questions at the end, is this film camp, retro, a classic, or just an old movie?
Isn't that the last one? Is that
no, that's number one.
That's number one. I think it's a classic, actually. Yeah. I think over time, I think if you had asked 18-year-old Nell, I would have said camp initially. Mm-hmm. But now revisiting this film and revisiting the story that it was trying to tell, I find that it's a very classic tale. And I think if you're a person who grew up thinking that, like, I want something different for my life, I need to go to college, I need to do something like this, it really kind of connects with that. And I love that I love the ending. Like, now thinking about the ending is actually about two people apologizing and realizing their mistakes. That doesn't happen. Like, that really doesn't happen.
We don't make that, which is maybe why it wasn't.
In mainstream movies, especially. Mainstream. Yeah.
I would say it's a lost classic.
Yeah.
I would call it a lost classic. I would say because of the penis scene... you know, and we're Americans and we don't see those things in movies much, so that becomes what defines a film.
Yeah.
I remember it was that one of our professors at St. Francis was saying about the piano. She asked a friend, oh, you saw it? Yeah, Harvey Keitel's penis is in it. Like, and that was literally that friend. She was like, that all you got from the movie? Like, and it...
Yeah.
But it does, like, overwhelm a film. But looking now, you know, we're 40 years past Reagan or whatever is going on. And we're just seeing how destroyed our country is because of that. This is such an amazing sort of cautionary tale from the past. And to see it now and to realize that, you know, we are lucky enough that we had the support, got to make it out, made all the right moves or whatever. Or actually, no, made tons of mistakes, at least from my case, made tons of mistakes, but had a safety net and was fine. And, you know, my dad was able to pay for my education. It's a very interesting, like, thing to look back at. This change that happened in America that we are still fully realizing the after effects of. And I think about our younger friends who don't even have parents that can bail them out. Their parents are our age and didn't make it. and can't. So it's definitely, I think, a lost classic that needs to be revisited. It's like, you want to understand the Reagan era, the rise of neoliberalism, I'll use the academic term, All the Right Moves is the film, I think, to look at.
It also has an interesting pedigree because Michael Chapman is actually better known for his cinematography. Mm-hmm. He did like Raging Bull and Taxi Driver.
Yes.
So he's actually really collaborated with some famous directors. And then John DuPont, he did Basic Instinct, and he was the cinematographer on this film. So you actually had two pretty talented men who were affiliated with this film. But it is for me a very much a lost classic. I agree with you completely. And I think it also got swallowed with Risky Business and Top Gun, like for his bigger.
Well, you think about films. Was this, you know, not only did Tom Cruise not, you know, be able to do the body double thing, but also was this one of the last films Tom Cruise tried to act in?
Oh, that's,
you know, our theater director, Kenny Rosinski, always said, you know, Hollywood actors of that era, of the VHS era, don't really act. They just project a persona.
Yeah.
Like for me, like the film I couldn't stand was The Departed. Mm. Because DiCaprio, Wahlberg, Nicholson, all of them just played themselves in a movie. They played their persona in a movie as characters. And that's all they did. And there was no acting. And so that was right before the rise of the Tom Cruise. And maybe this was the tone setter. He was the troubled loner, the troubled, talented, brilliant person in some way, but yet just couldn't get it together, and they had to overcome something, and he could just be Tom Cruise after this film, which is he's trying to act.
You think about like Magnolia, and there's one other film, I can't remember the name of it, where he did try to act, and those films didn't do great for him. And so he kind of went back. I mean, what do you talk about? His ability to do action scenes is really what people talk about when you talk about a Tom Cruise film.
Which, again, he could do that in this film, too. I mean, he got concussions. So, I think we're also then answering the second question about the social political distance.
So I actually...
One more thing. Yeah, well, you can go ahead, because I want to talk about something else.
Okay. I actually was just going to say, when you think about race in this film, it's actually very fascinating. Let me talk about gender first, and then we can go into the race. So I think the portrayal of race and gender is very interesting in this film. So Leah Thompson, whose character is Lisa, not that much different from her name. You don't see her really interact with a lot of other girls her age. All of her scenes tend to be with Tom Cruise. But, like, in those scenes, she's talking about, like, her hopes and dreams and where she wants to see her life
go. She's a complex character.
She's a very complex character. And then her conversation with the coach, she does end up talking, of course, about a relationship with Tom Cruise, with Steph. But it's this very mature conversation, knowing fully well that if she helps Steph get to college, she might not follow him, and he might not come back for her, and he might fail college. Like, we just don't know what's going to happen. But she knows that if he doesn't get this step, he's stuck there, and he's stuck there with her. And what does that really mean?
They get to be together.
To get to be together, but to be together in a stuck situation.
Yeah.
And so for me, she is a very dynamic character, a very interesting character, a very strong character. I loved her. I thought she was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Now, her friend who does get pregnant, it's really about those conversations of like, I'm pregnant now. There's not anything really dynamic there that you see. But I do think there's some really pivotal scenes. The other part about it is fascinating is the portrayal of race.
Yes.
And actually, this film really, really focuses on socioeconomic status, right?
And class solidarity.
And class solidarity. Yeah, I agree with
you. And, you know, the weird Johnstown connection, you know, 2016, 2017, Politico did articles about Johnstown because... In this sea of Republican red in central Pennsylvania, Johnstown was always this little blue dot. There was still one Democratic stronghold institution, the Mirtha District in Johnstown, that was blue. And in 2016, it had flipped red. It had gone conservative. And the point of both of those Politico articles were very much about race and how people had turned to race. And there's been some really horrific things that happened in Johnstown. There was the guy at the Palin rally at the War Memorial in 08 who brought a monkey, a stuffed monkey. There was a guy a few years ago who, you know, drove around on MLK Day celebrating with, like, stickers on his truck and stuff, celebrating James Earl Ray. And we're watching this era now where, at that time, working class somehow became a metonym for white Americans with bad jobs. Mm-hmm. And that working class somehow became this white thing. And I had friends like, oh, they lost the working class. And I was like, well, actually, the polling says African Americans who made less than $60,000 a year voted 0% for Donald Trump. Those, or 30,000, I think it was, 0% for Trump. How are those folks not working class?
Right.
And how did they get lost? And it's like, no, they voted for the other person. And so this is a really interesting moment of class solidarity, and that the community is cross-racial. Now, there is the interesting scene, the pep talk scene before the big game, where Craig T. Nelson uses the N-word.
Yeah.
To say, like, we're all in this together, which I don't know if you'd use that word today, but there is, again, this attempt that we are all this working class garbage and we're going to show these rich kids.
And he does like say like Polacks and like does slur.
Yeah, which I mean, are, you know, whatever.
But
you know,
I think, but
that,
I
that
think,
word yeah. is, you know, triggering. Yeah. And that's so interesting to me that it, that you have this sense of the multiracial working class.
Yeah.
Which is so, what we need now.
Yeah. And I think the sense of like, the students, like, the football players, there doesn't seem to be a racial divide. So the coach does use inappropriate language, but like
in this weird attempt to like, we're all in this together.
Yeah. We're all kind of all poor working class people who people degrade. But I think like the interactions of the teammates together, they're friends and they like each other.
They love each other.
And it's, there's this really close connection,
and they have a common struggle. I mean,
the
party scene, there's that great party scene where it's like just teen drinking in somebody's house, and again they're all together and they're all talking about the same struggles and anxieties.
And there's the same celebration whether if you're white or African-American of getting a scholarship. They were happy for each other. And I think that was pretty amazing to see that solidarity in that particular film, because you could have seen this like breakdown along racial barriers and slurs and everything happening. That was amazing to see. And I agree with you in terms of the thought of like working class has become viewed as white working class, right?
Yeah, rural white working
rural
class.
Rural white working class.
In places like Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Yeah. But so then the next, maybe we can put these two kind of questions together in terms of, you know, is there a technical distance between the film? I mean, there's no effects.
Yeah.
And those football scenes are really realistic. And the room test, is there anything that's so dated and off that sticks out?
Soundtrack. The soundtrack is the music. And I think that is such an 80s thing of having like the big song that goes with it.
Blue skies forever. It's overproduced. Yeah.
Yeah. That is definitely.
There's that. And there's a scene where they're walking in the alley. The scene where Leah Thompson is angry at Tom Cruise for, you're going to get a scholarship and I can't. Someone spray painted Elton John on a garage.
And yes.
I was like, who cares so much
at that time
about
either.
Elton John that they would tag something? Elton John! And his answer is people from Johnstown, actually. That's the thing. The soundtrack is a bit
dated.
It's incredibly dated. But everything else is the cars, the fashion, whatever.
The housing.
The soundtrack is the only thing that sticks out. But you're right, that film looks like Johnstown. That film was shot in Johnstown. The high school is gone.
Yeah.
They tore that building down. It's now a hotel there on that spot. But that still looks like Johnstown. And it certainly was the Johnstown that I remember when I was a young kid. But that's the only thing that sticks out. So we're on to the final question, which is this film a keeper? And I think we're saying...
It's a keeper.
It's a keeper.
It's a keeper.
It's something, hey, you know how to use Google. You can find a way to stream it. It's I think it's worth taking a look at. And it's worth taking a look at, especially in this era of our country's history.
Absolutely. And I think it's also this time capsule of labor that doesn't necessarily exist anymore, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, even though there's still steel mills here in Western Pennsylvania, because of technology, they don't function and need the labor force that they did in the past. And so that's also
some assembly line jobs now need electrical engineering degrees.
Yeah.
Which is the weird thing is Tom Cruise goes to college to be an engineer, and in some cases, that engineer could then have an assembly line job.
Yeah. But I do think it's a keeper. I do think it was a well-structured story. And I do think there's a lot to learn from his struggle. And though at the end he does get the degree,
he
gets the scholarship. I apologize.
We don't know about the degree.
He is offered a scholarship, but we don't know if he messes it up, right? Because there's also that still possibility.
He
still has to make all the right moves a certain grade point average, he loses his scholarship.
He gets hurt.
Football injury, he loses his scholarship. So you don't know. I mean, so it ends on a high note, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's a happy ending because we don't know if he actually graduates.
It's survive in advance.
Yeah.
He survives and advances, and that's the best he can get.
But I do like the focus on class solidarity. I do like the focus on his relationship with Leah Thompson. I love that character, and I do like the journey that he takes through that. And I think if you come from a working class background, you do understand this pressure and need to try to move on from it. And your last final thoughts on it?
I agree with everything, and there's this fleeting glimpse of Cruise junk. So, I mean, why would you not want to see this film? Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll watch another movie at some point and do this again. Bye.